9 o'clock, we'll call this committee meeting for April 12th, 2024 to order. Let me make an announcement while I have it on my mind, and so I'll be sure to get this out. We have our regular next meeting on May the 2nd, starting at 1 o'clock. We've kind of taken a consensus and have agreed that we will move that back to noon that day. I understand CJ has a commitment that afternoon at 2, and we're trying to give her a little leeway in there. So, well, we appreciate all your efforts and contributions, and we want you to be here for the meeting, but we want you to be able to take care of your other responsibilities as well. So,
thank you so much.
Please make a note on your calendar that the second quarter board meeting will commence here at noon on May the 2nd. All right, with that out of the way, Madam Secretary Bridget Thomas, would you please call our roll?
I will. Regent Bell. Regent Ball. Regent Brinkley.
Present.
Barely. Regent Bobby.
Present.
Regent Dennison.
Here.
Chair Milliken.
Here.
Regent Nichols. Regent Spiller.
Present.
Secretary Thomas. Vice Chair West.
Present.
And Regent Kurtz.
Here.
We have 9 regents present.
Very good. The first item of business this morning is the Academic Affairs Committee. Regent Spiller will be taking care of that since Regent Bale is otherwise engaged.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. We have a committee today that's reduced in numbers but not in knowledge, so we're going to turn a few action items. We turn it over to Provost Fisher.
We have 3 action items to take up today. The first is the approval of the undergraduate certificate in personal branding, and we have Dr. Merrill Price here to speak to it.
Good morning. Well, I'm here for Dean Brown, who can't be with us today, and you may have seen him standing up in front of you on previous committee meetings to talk about revamping of curriculum in PCAL. So we are suspending some programs, we are revamping some programs, we are updating others, and we are adding some new ones. And today we are in additive mode. And the first one that I'm going to talk about today is the personal branding certificate. Now, one of the things that I say to incoming freshmen when I do their TOPA orientation and their parents is that some of the jobs that they will have when they leave this university haven't been invented yet. And this, I think, is particularly true for personal branding. When I was in school, I would certainly have not had a clue what a personal branding certificate was. And in fact, even this week, I was frantically researching what a personal branding certificate was. And I have my notes here, so you'll have to give me grace while I consult them, because I want to get the language right. So this certificate is an interdisciplinary certificate that's offered by the School of Media and Communication, and it addresses the need for our 21st century graduates to develop for themselves a strong and identifiable digital presence. And this will make them marketable in 2 ways. One, it makes them stand out from the crowd for employers, and 2, it allows them to develop the skills in promotion that the certificate will allow them to develop and to articulate, which is a really important part of this program. So by the end of the program, they will not only have a strong personal brand strategy, but also a portfolio of content that they can demonstrate to potential employers so that they can successfully position themselves in a modern job market with this expertly curated online presence. So we expect that this certificate will appeal to students across the university, and that it will enhance student employability and also to address needs in the industry. Any questions?
So as an interdisciplinary program and one that is a certificate, it should appeal to a lot of students in different areas who are trying to build their own personal brand, as you say, something new to us,
absolutely,
to go with whatever particular area they are looking to be successful in.
Yes, and one area that's been mentioned in particular is that with the changes to name and likeness, this might be something that student-athletes find to their advantage.
I was surprised at one figure in this presentation and amazed at another. I was a little surprised at 45% of Gen X participants. That's a little higher than I probably thought it would be. But I was amazed at the $16.4 billion economic impact that this will have in 2023.
It's astonishing.
That's not small change.
Nope. And it's proliferating year after year. It's exponential.
Any other questions or comments? Not, I'll entertain a motion. Second.
First.
I'll make a motion or so moved.
So moved.
CJ, you're muted there.
It's me.
All right. Having the first and the second, all those in favor, we're going to, so we can put a letter.
There we go.
Second. Hearing first and second, all those in favor, please say aye.
Aye.
Aye. That's all. So, thank you, sir. Second
one. Second one has to do with approval of a minor in piano pedagogy, and Dr. Price will approach this too.
Thank you. That's me again. This one is a little more traditional. One, it's a minor. A 26-hour minor. It is offered in the music department. It is offered primarily to music majors, and it is a minor in piano pedagogy. Many of our students in music, particularly those in piano, will end up teaching at some point, whether it's on their way to their degree or whether it's later, whether it's private lessons, whether it's group lessons, whether it's in some other environment. We do currently have some basic piano pedagogy courses in the department, but we have students who have asked about pursuing piano pedagogy further, and when they have done that, they have done so through independent study courses, and that has meant that although they develop the skills, those skills are not reflected in their credentials. So this is an opportunity to dig a little deeper into piano pedagogy for those students. It's a creative minor. It has some things like music entrepreneurship involved in it. It also has a developmental psychology course involved in it, and it also has some service learning. So it will give these students the opportunity to work with diverse populations. So a little bit different from a traditional piano pedagogy minor. There's a lot of interest in this from students who are currently in the program, and this will give them the opportunity to win competitive graduate assistantships, for example, but also to teach for themselves and to go into academia, perhaps, or into other areas where music pedagogy will be important.
So a question for the provost.
Sure.
Just, we got a certificate, and we have a minor, and we have a graduate certificate. Could you just help the board understand a little bit?
Sure.
Why we might do a minor versus a certificate?
Yeah, I mean, I think certificates are designed to be open to everybody, usually interdisciplinary as we speak, as we put them in, and in a large number of cases, I think go across all age groups. So as we move forward with online education on this campus and continue to expand it, we see the certificates as the perfect in places like Nashville and that, where people are trying to be retooled and that. Minors are more on campus. Minors are to be filled in with the majors who are on campus. They have a greater number of hours associated with them, and they are meant to be add-ons so that you can improve your CV or resume.
And if I could just add to that, the other thing about certificates is that they are standalone credentials, which means that you can come here simply for a certificate, whereas you can't come here simply for a minor, and in some cases you're eligible for financial aid for pursuing a certificate.
And remember last time we were here, we had the stackable certificates, and that's the hope as we move forward, is you create stackable certificates like the business college has, where somebody comes in and takes one or maybe takes two and then finds out they have now 30 hours, and maybe it's okay to finish the graduate degree or the undergraduate degree. And we continue to stack those certificates on each other to get a degree.
Any other questions or comments? I'll entertain a motion.
So moved.
I make a motion.
Second.
Good, yeah.
CJ, motion. Regent Kurtz, the second, and all those in favor of this, please say aye.
Aye.
Of course. CJ, there we go. None opposed.
Yes.
Thank you, Regent Nichols, and
thank you, Dr. Rice. Third is approval of the graduate certificate in the School of Social Work, and Dr. Aaron Warfel is here.
Good morning, everyone. Thank you for the opportunity to speak about this very important certificate that will meet a growing need in our community. It's no secret that youth mental health challenges are on the rise, and this certificate would prepare our graduates to eliminate a barrier to access within the school. So a graduate certificate in school social work, again, to address the growing concern with youth mental health challenges, chronic absenteeism, school violence. The certificate has been developed in collaboration with Green River Regional Educational Cooperative, GREC, as well as the College of Education and Behavioral Sciences to ensure that we're meeting the requirements for graduates to be employable within school districts locally and nationwide. The certificate would require students to take a course in trauma-informed school-based social work, as well as choose from a variety of courses related to legal and policy and clinical intervention and assessment. And those courses pull from a variety of disciplines as well, counseling, psychology, education, of course, psychological sciences. So it's very much a collaborative effort that would truly meet a need in our community and prepare graduates to meet that need and be employable within school districts. I could go on and on and on, but I'd be happy to answer any questions.
Just let me say.
Yes.
This is so needed.
Yes.
You know, there's so many.
Definitely.
There's so many students that need help.
So
and their parents work. They can't do the after school appointments.
Exactly.
And that's a huge issue. So. The research shows that students of marginalized populations living in poverty are 50 times more likely to receive mental health services if offered at school.
Yes.
So I think that says enough right there. So
absolutely.
Yes. I'm thrilled. I agree.
It's thrilled.
Thank you.
So I'm assuming teachers could go back and get this.
Yes. Well, they would be required to have a master's in social work with additional credits. But we are hopeful that our alumni, as well as alumni from other institutions that are working in schools but don't have the necessary credential with the Department of Education, could come back here to Western and earn that credential.
So I think I would
and be more
really
marketable.
Publish this, you know, in the local
yes.
schools, because I
absolutely.
Feel like there would be a big demand for this.
Absolutely. And our collaboration with Greg has been really wonderful to assist with that as well.
Any other questions or comments? If not, Regent Nichols, I'll entertain a motion.
Yes, make a motion for the sociology certificate. I think it's awesome.
We got a second. All those in favor say aye.
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 Those opposed? There's no one left. Thank you.
Thank you.
So we have two information items today. I'd like to start off with Professor Becca Andrews. Becca Andrews joined us in 2023. She's an award-winning investigative journalist who's published in such areas as Mother Jones, Rolling Stone, Wired, Teen Vogue, and The New Republic, among other publications. She has a new debut book out. That's The Destruction of Roe versus Wade and the Fight to Protect a Fundamental American Right. And today she's here to talk to you about reporting on abortion access in a post-Dobbs America. There she is.
Thanks. Hey, y'all. If you'll indulge me, I'm going to do the obnoxious author thing.
We got to get it up.
Contractually obligated to do that. So yes, as Bud said, I am an investigative reporter. I'm so thrilled to be teaching here at Western Kentucky University. My focus has traditionally been in narrative and investigative reporting, so I write primarily for magazines and for online publications, but let me take a little bit more of a human-focused, narrative, creative, nonfiction approach to my work. I also operate in covering abortion access under something called the reproductive justice framework. It's a term that was coined by Black women in the 90s who felt that the right to abortion movement wasn't meeting their needs because it wasn't talking about abortion access in the broader context of reproductive health care. It wasn't talking about how abortion access should exist alongside the right to have children and to raise those children in a healthy environment with access to clean water and education. I wasn't talking about the need for contraception and for women to be able to control their reproductive destinies. So that's the way that I try to approach abortion access as a journalist, thinking about it as one part of a larger whole. I wrote this book a couple of years ago, right as the Dobbs decision was coming down. I actually was supposed to turn in the book several months later than I ended up turning it in, because when the Supreme Court memo leaked, my publisher called me and was like, you know those 3 months that you had sketched out to revise the book and make it all pretty, you don't have that anymore, we're going to rush it out, so you need to get on the road and report and get it done. So I did. I didn't sleep more than like 4 hours a night for a good 6 weeks. It was horrible. I hope I never have to do that again. But what it did was it really forced me to get out and understand the repercussions of what was happening on the ground in real time as the Dobbs decision was coming into effect. The book is driven, again, by human narrative. I reached out to everyone that I could possibly find to talk to who had experience with abortion pre-Roe to post-Roe. In the book, I write about how areas like the South have been in a post-Roe reality for a long time now. Our access has been curbed in a lot of different ways, and what that has meant for families and economic situations here in the South, among other areas of the United States. But mostly, you know, my goal as a writer is to come at this with human empathy. It's to show what people are really dealing with. It's to show people as fully fledged humans in all their complexities and all their flaws. Hopefully the book achieves that. Since then, I have been freelancing, and freelancing in tandem with my teaching, which it turns out is really an ideal balance for me. I love continuing to be in the field while I am also in the classroom. Because my industry is changing so quickly, because every time you turn around, another newsroom has shut down and another is sprung up to replace it, and the jobs are changing so quickly, I find it really helpful that I've kept one foot in my industry, that I am still working with editors constantly and hearing how those developments are taking place, and then relaying that to my students. Last fall, I published a story in Mother Jones where I followed an abortion provider who lives in East Tennessee to New Mexico, where he's working. So a lot of providers who haven't wanted to leave their home, even in states where practice has been banned, are now traveling great distances to offer that kind of care. So that was a feature-length investigation. I spent a lot of time with Dr. Aaron Campbell on the road. That, to me, is my ideal reporting situation, where I'm spending a lot of time with one person, I'm really getting to know them, I'm really getting to understand why they do the things that they do, and then I get to write that for people to read and think about what it's like to be in the shoes of someone they might not encounter in their everyday lives. My beat expands into anything, I think, that affects reproductive health care. So to that end, I published a story a few weeks ago in a newer publication called Capital in Maine that looks at unionization efforts within Planned Parenthood affiliates. I was hearing a lot of Planned Parenthood workers saying we're not being compensated fairly, post-Dobbs demand has risen, and we're working longer hours, but we're not getting paid for that, and our families are suffering as a result. So it was important to me to also cover that because they're saying this is affecting patient care. There aren't enough of us. There aren't enough of us being hired to do our job, and as a result, we are making mistakes. So I published that in Capital Maine that had a data element. So I went through and I did a lot of data analysis of which affiliates were unionizing and which affiliates weren't to give kind of a bird's eye view of what this phenomenon looks like and how it's moving throughout space. What's really fun for me is while I'm reporting these and I'm teaching, I'm talking to my students about my reporting process. So for example, in the course of reporting this story, I was using a tool based out of MIT called the Living Wage Calculator. It's really cool. My poor students are so tired of hearing me nerd out about it. But essentially what you do is you put in the zip code of where someone lives. You can adjust it for their family size. Is it, you know, a single parent home? Is it a two-parent household? What does the income stream look like? And the calculator will generate what a living wage should look like for a family of that size. That was really useful in writing the story about what labor wages should look like for these workers and giving people an idea of what the disparity was there. So getting to bring that back into my classroom and say, like, hey, you guys are working on these stories right now. This is a tool that could be really useful is a lot of fun. I also find that my students really respond well to the fact that I am still in the field and that I do have these editor contacts and that I do I can connect them with internships. I think they enjoy that in my sometimes dry lecturing, there are also anecdotes about things that have happened to me in the field and on the road. So they get the mechanics of journalism and they get what it means to be out there reporting a story and the responsibility of that, but they also get the joy behind it and the fun that I get to have out in the field. And I've really seen that translate for the students. We had a campus protest a few weeks ago. Several of my students went out and covered it. I had two students in particular who were so excited to just be out there interviewing people and talking to people about what was going on. They would kind of like bounce out and like interview somebody and they'd really excitedly come back to me and tell me all about it and then bounce back out. It was just like seeing the joy of learning what it means to be in the field and having that permission to talk to people who maybe otherwise you wouldn't get to talk to was, I mean, it's the whole reason that I'm here. It's the whole reason that I'm teaching. Currently, I'm also looking at the intersection between anti-abortion, right-wing, and white supremacist extremism. I'm doing that in an investigative podcast form with John Archibald at AL.com. He's a Pulitzer Prize winner and also just a really amazing reporter. So we're taking his expertise, having covered a clinic bombing in Birmingham in the 90s, with my expertise in what anti-abortion extremism looks like, and we're revisiting the case of Eric Robert Rudolph, who bombed the Olympics in Atlanta in the 90s and two abortion clinics in the South, as well as a lesbian nightclub. He killed two people and injured more than 100 people. I'm uncovering right now connections to what his involvement with an anti-abortion group called Army of God looks like. We have proven that he went to Coeur d'Alene, Idaho to seek some advice from a white supremacist group there that had not been previously established. And I also, it's a new medium for me. I've never done podcasting. I've never taken investigative work and translated it into an audio form. So I'm also really enjoying getting to talk about that as I learn it and teach it to my students. And that's what I got. Any questions?
The podcast again, what's the name of the podcast?
We think it's going to be called Wrath of God. It hasn't come out yet. It'll come out in the fall. It'll be probably an 8-episode limited series. And we're also working with a documentary production company to potentially spin it off into a documentary series.
Well, thank you so much for your great work.
Thank you.
Very impressive. We're fortunate to have you.
I appreciate that. It's fun. I'm lucky to get to do what I do.
Professor Andrews,
congratulations on the book and the work. And for us, when we talk about applied learning and the context in which we work as a university, the differentiator for us in the marketplace with our students is not just the relationship with faculty, but the relationship between theory to practice and making knowledge useful, putting ideas into action, is how we describe it. And this is just a perfect example of how it is you take subject matter reporting, but enliven it by demonstrating how it works in the real world and then giving students the opportunity to practice it in a safe environment. And my hope and what I know is we do this across all of our degree programs, but just a great exemplar. So congratulations.
Thank you. Thanks, y'all.
Thank you. Second information item has to deal with faculty handbook revision, section 7, termination of faculty. It was sent to you so that you could take a look at it. That came out of an incident that occurred a couple of years ago as we used the dismissal process, and we were asked to look at it again, and working with the Faculty Senate and the Provost Office, what you see in front of you is what everybody has come up with as the new process to be used, and it was passed by the Faculty Senate. So it sits on my desk as we speak, and we're here today to describe the process to you. And I have two people, Professor Zadoen and Professor Hale, here to talk to you about it. They were the leads in putting it together.
Can we just stand for here?
Sure.
Come on, man. You want to
stand? I'm with the camera. Set the tone,
Shane. Let the camera find you. All right, so as Bud said, we were tasked to revise the process a couple of years ago, and we took one crack at it last year, and we weren't successful, and so this year we restarted, and I think we were very successful. We started with what the American Association of University Professors recommends in a case like this. We looked at what our peers were doing. We looked at some of the issues we had. We used the process before, particularly timeline, clarity, who's supposed to be doing what, making sure we retain due process, keeping the regents involved, but in a different way, which is how AEP does it and some other schools do it. And so it was a really great example of shared governance, I'll say. Julie's been an excellent collaborator. She's been around for a while. She knows the handbook better than just about anybody. We worked with a subgroup of the Faculty Handbook Committee to come up with an initial crack at this. We shared it with the full Faculty Handbook Committee, had some back and forth, and it brought it to the Senate a few weeks ago, and they passed it. So we're bringing it to you to see if you have any questions, particularly about your role in the process. We heard some things about how you guys wanted to operate with this, and so we tried to factor those in, but this is what we got for now.
Can you walk us through what's changed, what's different about this versus what we had before?
Sure, I can certainly try.
Before she starts, just real quick, I would like you, because Julie's worked in this area so long, to let her establish her credentials.
Oh, sure.
She's done.
You're qualified as an expert, right? Yeah. So I guess I'm the poster child for shared governance, at least from the faculty perspective on campus. I started my 21st year at WKU in January, and I've been chair of Senate 4 times, vice chair twice. I have been chair of Handbook 4 different times. I was on the committee that revamped the handbook for the first time in about 10 years, back in 2008 and 2009. I have been chair of academic quality, chair of faculty welfare, so I've kind of done it all and seen a lot of different perspectives on shared governance. So it has been my my honor to try and instill that on campus, you know, in kind of a grassroots kind of approach to shared governance. So I think, my hope is that this establishes a precedent for future, because this is a major thing. I mean, this is not just let's move some words around on paper. I mean, this is a pretty significant change. And my hope is my credibility in Senate has helped get it through the process a little bit. We did have a little bit of a stumbling block. Senate is a little caught up in some verbiage in the charter as to how what is basically the effect of policy that's dealt with in the handbook should be processed through the Senate. So we did table it for a month, giving faculty more of an opportunity to review it and consider it. And then it came back basically with no questions and passed unanimously.
So now I think this question of what's changed, I think this
would be. So, in August of 22, after the dismissal for hearing that occurred in the summer of 22, I approached the provost and said, hey, can we sit down and have a conversation about that process? And, for those of you in the room that don't, I'm an attorney, so I try and keep that hat off for the most part and wear my faculty hat. But, there are just some things that kind of stuck out to me from that process. So I sat down with Rob and Provost Fisher, and I said, hey, these are some things I have concerns about. So we talked about due process. We talked about notice and opportunity for a faculty person to respond to allegations. We talked about the timeline as far as how quickly things were getting through or not getting through the process. We talked about evidentiary, like burdens of proof, because that was not, in my mind, clear at all as to what needed to be proved and by whom. And then we talked about the authority of the board and statutorily what that required. We also talked about the authority of the faculty who are already involved in the process in various committee forms, and whether or not we wanted to keep that and how we maybe wanted to change the authority of the committee. So those, I think, are kind of the primary issues.
So Bud and I came in with a list, too, and our lists were almost identical, right? We had concerns about the vagaries of the old process, and so we were able to clean a lot of that up.
Yeah, and I know it appears very lengthy, but what we are replacing, in my mind, was very cursory and vague and ambiguous and didn't really protect anybody on this campus. It wasn't a benefit to faculty. It wasn't a benefit to administration. And I didn't believe it was a benefit to the board either. So we've tried to clarify those roles much more clearly and, again, build in that due process to the system.
So my understanding is that what we've really done at the core of this is take the hearing that happened at the board level and actually make that the purview of faculty.
Yes. Faculty are triers of fact at this point, yep. And we've taken that responsibility from the board. The board is still involved and can review as much as it wants to based upon that recommendation of faculty in you, President Cabone, but they are no longer going to sit as a jury, so to speak.
And then the other question I have is, what is the board process? My reading of it, it doesn't look like you've delineated the board process to decide to read stuff, not read stuff. What does that process look like for the board?
I think the board has the freedom to review any of the record it chooses based upon your recommendation and their interpretation of your recommendation. And they can accept your recommendation or not accept your recommendation. So I think the board still has the kind of the final veto, so to speak, in the process as to, okay, we agree with the recommendations that have come up through the process, or we don't. And if we don't, that basically is the final word. If we do, then, whatever proceedings, if it's a recommendation for dismissal, then those proceedings would begin.
But that board conversation, that's my board question. What does that look like? Because who decides what that board process looks like? Is it a conversation among the executive committee? Is it the full board? Is there a vote?
It was my intent, and maybe that hasn't been clearly communicated, that it would be a full board decision.
I think it would be closed
sessions.
Yeah.
Okay, that makes sense.
Because it's a personnel. Yeah. Again, we tried to build that concept into the process too, as to whether it's going to be public and what record is generated.
And I think this is the faculty handbook, right? So I think it would be helpful for the board. And my hope and dream is that we don't have to ever use this policy.
Right.
But if we do, I think it would be wise for the board to kind of, while there's nothing happening, to make a plan for if something does happen, this is how we'll handle this.
So I think the last faculty handbook had a lot of prescriptive steps for the board.
I think I can say we found restrictive as we were working through it for those that were in the room that day. And the way I read this is we get to decide. And I expressed that to this group as they were working, that we don't really need them to write policy for us. We need to decide what we think fulfills our obligation. So the questions you're asking, I think we need to decide. The board needs to decide.
Agreed.
I agree with that too. Yeah. And, you know, I mean, just certain things about, it says a copy of the evidentiary record will be submitted, but then, like you said, we could look at anything we wanted to, so I don't know. That doesn't seem to be clear in there that we could look at anything.
Well, our hope is the evidentiary record will be everything.
Will include everything.
Again, we're hoping that the record that's generated that is consistent from level in the process to level in the process, so that we're not having, and again, I don't like to refer to what happened before, but there were parts of the evidence that I didn't believe were necessarily in the record officially. So we're hoping that, you know, from the very beginning, when the committee is looking at this, when the charges come up, that entire record is generated at that point in time, and there will be an official version of that, and that will be everything. There should not be anything that was not considered by the committee and then not considered by the provost and the president and not be able to be considered by you.
So at this point, this still has to be accepted by academic affairs?
Yes.
So if the board put together and had talked with the chair and Regent Bell about this, if we put together a small task force from the board to talk about what our steps should be and make a recommendation to the full board in consultation with council, and to make sure we're fulfilling our legal obligations, would that seem like a fair process to move forward? So maybe the chair, Regent Bell, as the chair of academic affairs, and myself as a faculty, anyone else who'd want to, try to have that adopted by a good, is that changing, it's not changing the delegation of authority, it's changing our bylaws, where would we codify that process, where do we have to make
the bylaws, there's a place to change the delegation of authority and adopt it based on what you've just shared. Sounds like a good point.
Be able to participate.
If I could make one other comment, first, to thank you very much for the leadership at Rockwell. A great example of how shared governance does work on this campus, as much as people talk about it not working so much. But the other is that I think this centers the evaluation and decision making in the area where it needs to, which is around faculty expertise. And so while I appreciate the previous process had the board exercising its full responsibility, the reality is these are such narrow questions that require an understanding that an average citizen would not have. Putting it in the hands of faculty, to me, is a tremendous improvement. And so I'm thankful for that as well. It demonstrates also for some of our legislators who don't believe that there is post-tenure review or consequences for incompetence or whatever, or malfeasance, it demonstrates that we take this very seriously, that there are evaluations, and then when on the rare occasion when someone meets a criteria for tenure being revoked, that we have a process that takes it seriously as well. And so tenure is not a job for life, as they sometimes describe. There are significant evaluations, and on the rare occasion where it comes to a difficult decision point, there's a respectful yet well thought out process too. So, thank you.
If I may just make a quick comment on that, I thought that was very well said, and a very important step toward, you know, again, embedding that concept of shared governance on this campus. I just want to make sure that the board, and I know you appreciate this, but I feel like it needs to be said that the faculty, first of all, on the ad hoc committee are volunteers. You know, we put in I don't know how many hours on this thing, and the faculty are going to be sitting on these committees are also essentially volunteers. I mean, they are put into a pool by Senate, and then they're pulled out of a pool, but still they're doing this that is kind of over and above the teaching responsibility that we assume. I mean, it is a service, but I think we were very cognizant of putting that new responsibility on faculty when we were drafting this and talking to our colleagues about it and trying to really come up with what we thought was a really good alternative. And I think we did.
And I'll just add, it parallels a process that we already have in place where faculty have to vote if there's a promotion complaint. It parallels that process, so it makes it more familiar and consistent, which I think is also helpful.
So, two things. First, the chair has a wording suggestion that I'll share with you after the meeting. But first, one of the comments that I've heard on campus is we have gone through this process for the last 2 years, and I can't count the number of lengthy phone conversations we've had while I was on vacation sometimes. But anyway, so... some of the faculty have been concerned that the board is abdicating its authority here and that we're stepping out and we're just turning it over to the president. And I have assured them we are the governing body of this institution and we can't abdicate that authority. It's just we may come in a different way, still at the end, but in a different way and have a different amount of information given to us at that time. So just to still make that clear, what I was pushing for as part of this was the triers of fact, the due process occur at a different level to make sure that that work is done completely, as Chair Milligan said, as much as possible before it comes to us. But we are still the governing body of this institution, holding everyone accountable for those decisions. So.
Well, if I may, too, I would like to thank University Counsel's Office because, you know, your colleague really was a huge help to us and the Provost's Office, too. I mean, we all put a lot of work into this.
Not to put anything else on Julie's plate, but there is an allowance if the board forms a committee to have a non-board member on that committee for advisory purposes. So if there is a task force to discuss that language, I would imagine Jan as being in that room would be a good one for it that day. I'm not asking to be on that committee because I'm looking forward to not being on board in a couple of months. But Julie's really got the history with this, and I think she'd be a good member of that task force. Not to volunteer you, but I do think
that's fine. Keep in mind, I've got an end date here. Day of 25. So.
Yeah, I think that's a good idea.
Last comment, Julie, since you worked in Senate for so long, on this process of shared governance, can you speak to, and we get such a, I don't want to say slanted, but misunderstanding sometimes about that, and we're seeing at a flagship institution in the state some kind of deep questions about shared governance, the role of Senate. You've worked with this so long and so hard, can you talk about what you think the role of that is on a healthy campus?
I think it's a central role. I mean, I can't emphasize enough how important I think it is, which is why I've done everything that I've done. I can remember having our meetings with President Cavoni as chair of the Senate. You know, he would say, well, what does faculty think? And I'm like, well, President Cavoni, I can tell you what I think. But, you know, there are a lot of different viewpoints on campus, which I think is a very healthy thing. And I'm hoping that shared governance, you know, has the ability to shine a light on that and to bring those viewpoints together. And, you know, Senate has not always, you know, a consensus on issues, and that I don't think that's a bad thing. I think that it's good for me to hear other perspectives. It's good for our students to hear other perspectives. It's good for our students to see this process in action, I think. It's a central role. I think, you know, we cannot function to the best interest of everyone on this campus without it.
To Julie's point, one of the things that I've talked about for 7 years is this has to be a collaborative, not a combative process.
Right.
And that requires both trust, but time. And so one of the things that I've done is every month sit down with the chair of both Faculty Senate and Staff Senate in my office responding to any questions that they had. I've visited with the staff senate every time. I've been invited each year. We're going to have the same process for faculty senate to kick off the fall semester each year. I just think it is both a growth process, but also a trust building process. And we had a lot of work on the trust side to get to a better place. And I'm thankful for academic affairs really taking the lead on that. And I think we've made great strides compared to where we were 7 years ago.
And that addition to the process as the Senate and both faculty and staff, I think it's been hugely important to me. I mean, I just feel like it at least disseminates information. You know, at the point of agreement, that's a whole other issue, but at least it gets the information out there. So nobody, you know, the transparency factor is so important.
Any other questions or comments? Thank you very much for your time and your work.
Bridget Spiller, I've got to go to the housing board to make a presentation. So if you can just email me your change.
I'll show it to Brian.
Okay, thank you.
Thank you all so much for that presentation.
Thank you.
We certainly appreciate it.
Provost Bridget, before you step away, do you have an update on the presentation we saw last time? Did you participate in the SunSketcher app? Have we heard that?
Oh, Dave's here. I read the numbers, but I can't remember what they were. It was over a million people pictures, I know.
But yeah, so 36,000 people contributed their data. The data is still loading because it's 101 pictures per person. And it's spectacular. Even the initial data is already showing some results. It will take a while to analyze millions of pieces of data, but we're going to have a lot of students having a lot of fun making most precise measurements of the size of the sun. And it's going to lead to follow-up grants as well, so that future students are benefiting from this as well. It's a tremendous success. NASA has a full web page dedicated to thank you for contributing. And so I think it's the perfect model for what we do. We do cutting-edge research, and we train students at the same time to do important things.
It's also a classic citizen science.
It is.
And
it is
that, you know, where we get everybody involved across the country. And, you know, I talked to Gordon yesterday, and we were talking about it, and I asked him when he had some results that had all the data in it. I'd love to see it, and I'd love to share it with you guys, because that's what I really want to see. I want to know the size of the sun.
Yeah. Thank you, Provost Fisher.
Yep.
Here that concludes the presentation.
Very good. Thank you, sir. Chair Brody, on the Finance and Budget Committee.